Hello, everybody. Welcome to another edition of Burns and Holla, right here on the podcast for Jason. Hello, I'm Jason Rance. That is, of course, my former co-host. And
yes, I have a new co-host now, Jason.
I have not yet been invited onto the show, which is weird.
It's not weird.
That's very weird. I invite you onto this show.
Yeah, I know, but you know, you just got to give us time, and eventually we'll have you on.
You don't want to work on the Kings. Best guest right at the top. You want to hold off a little.
Yeah, exactly. But it's been fun. Everybody, you know Terry Holloman. He's a good guy. Mm-hmm. It's good to talk to him. Yeah, good dude. Nice guy. Yeah.
So lots for us to discuss from the world of news. Plus, I vaguely remember sending you a text message of something I wanted to talk about, and now I can't remember. I do know that it was entertainment related. Before we get into that, let's just jump into briefly the world of CHOP, because we're either in its waning days, where clearly they're not getting the crowd that they once got. It turns out when you murder someone and you have shootings that impact three individuals on top of the murder, it kind of scares people away. It's obviously gotten to the point where the folks who wanted to pretend that it was completely peaceful, that it was this complete utopia, it was a social justice homeland, as the New York Times called it, they were clearly wrong. It's not even that they were wrong. They were seeing what they wanted to see, and they chose not to be truthful.
Or were they right up until the moment they were wrong?
They weren't right. They were not right. There were some people out there, not everybody, but when you go and you see some of the coverage from the national outlets that are just sending in their reporter for, you know, the night, and they don't leave their hotel room, say, for like an hour in the middle of the day, they were calling it the street fair, and it's totally peaceful. It was never totally peaceful when you've got fights breaking out all the time.
It wasn't all the time.
There were fights all the time.
There were not fights all the time.
When you say something is peaceful.
That 6-block radius of Capitol Hill.
Hold on. Okay. When you call something peaceful, how would you define that from a reasonable perspective?
Nothing is 100% peaceful. I mean, there were fights.
Okay, that's a good start, right? Because some people were literally saying there's no violence whatsoever. So we know that you and I agree on that. That's nonsense, right? You and I agree that there's very clearly some level of violence. I think that when you step into CHOP, you automatically get stabbed or beat up? No. It's peaceful until it's not peaceful. And fights were routinely breaking out. And on top of that, there is an aura of of danger when you know that cops are not coming into the zone unless it was, you know, God forbid, a mass shooting. But I don't think that the national outlets, and I think the Seattle Times in particular, has been sort of a cheerleader for what they wanted CHOP to be. I just think they downplayed or completely ignored the dangerous element.
How so? Did they not cover any of the altercations? Did they not cover the shootings?
You said up until the shooting. So I'm saying before that.
Because a skirmish is not newsworthy. That's the thing. If it were, it wasn't nonstop. You act like one fight started.
Every time I've been there, there's been a skirmish. And I've spent some time there.
Every time you've been, which is how many times? Because usually you broadcast from the library.
Well, let's get into that in a second.
Yeah.
So I've been down there three times in the afternoon, mostly in the afternoon, and then once at night. Mm-hmm. Like literally in there. Obviously, I've done the hits. I'm not counting the TV stuff. So I've been down there, and every single time, look, again, is it a bang it out fight? No, but it wasn't peaceful when in any reasonable sense of the word. But now that clearly things have changed in the way that the media and some of the activists are talking about it.
Yes.
You can no longer make that claim.
Because it's simply indefensible at this point. You can't defend its existence any longer. I've gotten to that point. It's disappointing, but very predictable too. Because these sort of things shouldn't last this long. Because once they do, this is the inevitability of the outcome. And I remember this with the Occupy. I was living in Portland during all the Occupy encampments. Mm-hmm. And
which was national, wasn't just for folks.
It was all over, yeah. But one of the biggest ones was in Portland.
Yeah.
And the Occupy movement started very pure. It actually had good branding, which progressives were really bad at branding. We are the 99%. didn't require any further explanation.
Yeah. Kind of we know what that means.
Way that, exactly. It's not like defund the police where it's like, actually what we're mean. It's but then
such bad branding.
It's terrible
of all,
branding.
Of all it's the movements, bad. It's just like, it's, so you mean defund? Oh, no, no. Hey, dummy, when we say defund, we actually right. mean, no, that you've already lost.
Right. But what Occupy became, because it lasted so long, was just exactly what CHOP has become. Just people milling around all day. And then the Occupy camps actually in Portland ended up getting shut down because there's some instances of sex trafficking. So the mayor at that point. So these sort of movements end up having their breaking point. And for CHOP, it's the violence that we've seen over the past few days. I don't think that Mayor Durkan changes the way she talks about it without that sort of violence, because she, the way that they were dealing with it, it was kind of like, we're going to let you hang out there for the summer. And then once rainy season comes, you're just going to kind of, you're going to go home on your own. But it didn't seem like they were going to take any meaningful action. But when you have numerous shootings in the course of 72 hours, I mean, nobody's going to stand for that. And the thing about it is that the last couple times I've been there, when I first went, it was as an idea, it was fascinating. It was unprecedented. Like they just took the precinct and mm-hmm. everybody was talking about a singular topic, which was Black Lives Matter. And now it's just, I mean, the conversations like that aren't happening nearly as much. People are just hanging there. There's organized soccer rec leagues. Like it's sort of silliness at this point. And when you factor in the violence now, it's like,
but how
do you defend it?
Yeah, but before the quote-unquote violence from the shootings, you had a business that was a block away car tender that they caught a dude who was committing an arson. The business owners caught the guy. Now, it seems like this guy was actually just an opportunist, as have been many cases in the area of people realizing, oh, the cops aren't here, so I'm going to go and do some damage. So the business catches them, and then 100 to 200 protesters from CHOP show up and demand that the business owners turn the guy over to them. Now, at first, the question was, are you protecting this guy? And I actually, maybe some of them were, but I don't think that was the goal. I think they thought they were going to be the police. Except in the case of this dude, this 21-year-old who's got a rap sheet that's pretty significant. I think he was arrested, I want to say, 3 days before this. And he was arrested the same night as this arson. They searched him. They took a jacket from him, which apparently belonged to the business. And they said, here's the jacket. Although, remember, this mob threatened to burn the building down if they didn't turn him over, which is just kind of weird. And then they physically assaulted the guy. And the irony of creating your own police force or security force at a time where you're calling out the SPD and policing in general as barbaric and committing acts of police brutality, you go ahead and just beat this guy up when you're in charge is just, it's too rich, but no one really talked about that. They didn't say that that was part of the violence.
Because of my ignorance to the story, I have to accept your version of it.
I've got the police report. I'll shoot you an email.
But it's the Stanford experiment, right? You start giving people power over other people and they're going to get a thirst for that power. If you're not familiar with the Stanford experiment, look it up. It's not worth explaining right now, but
there was a movie that was based on.
There is. It's
of the same. Mediocre. I haven't seen it.
Yeah. It's people who get the authority to be bad to other people and take advantage of that authority and crave more authority. And that was inevitable in CHOP when they were suddenly appointing leaders and things like that. It's human nature to become authoritarian when you're given power over others. And it was definitely going to happen.
Well, in a system without any rules. I mean, that's really what this is about. So you, at least in that scenario with the Stanford, like you had a basic set of rules and an infrastructure, you know, generally how it's supposed to work as a jail, you know, generally what people are supposed to do. In the case of CHOP, there was none of that. There was no leader whatsoever. In fact, there were a whole bunch of different people who believed that they were leaders of some movement, but they couldn't quite define it because no one was. They have this general sense of what they're doing there, but nothing specific. Versus, and you know this about me, I'm not particularly moved by anything. That's just not. I don't get inspired in the same way by activism. But the march that was silent last, like two Fridays ago, I can't remember the date. I looked at some of the images. I was like, that's inspiration. That's like legitimately inspirational. I may not agree with all of the policy prescriptions that come out of the movement, but there's some stuff that I 100% support. And I can't remember if you and I talked about it, the whole idea of a social worker that's embedded with the SPD. There's a lot of questions that need to be answered and how this could be done safely. But on paper, I love that idea. And so right now you've got the conservative dude who's super pro-police siding again in, on paper with a position of the anti-cop side or the folks who are critical of cops. Like, this seems like a really good opportunity to come together instead of being divisive. And yet CHOP was nothing, at least to me, and I think to reasonable people, as inherently divisive because you can't.
What do you think? Like, are you painting yourself as like the great healer now? You make a living off of being divisive.
I don't. I try to bring people together under my version of common sense.
So when you're rebelling against an institution that you felt has been unjust for hundreds of years, I don't think that's the time you're going to accept any sort of olive branch, right? That sort of makes sense to me. The hope is, though, that going forward, when the ludicrous manifesto that came out of CHOP is complete, it was silliness, and it contradicted.
It conflicted with each other. My favorite one was, and this was, I believe it was in order. The first one was, we're going to retry every person of color who's currently serving a sentence. The next one is, we're getting rid of prisons.
It felt like stoner talk. Like, did you? I remember just like being stoned in high school and be like, "We're going to set up our own
degenerate drug user like you."
We're going to set up a record label and we're going to do it right. We're going to give 100% of the profits to the bands, and we're going to donate 100% of the profits to charity. Like, it was just it read like 17-year-old stoner planning. It wasn't well, but I saw someone ask on Twitter, I think it was Terry actually, what has been positive outcomes from these protests? And there have been some. There's the federal ban on chokeholds now. There's the repositioning of the police
union.
Well,
the federal ban wasn't approved. Remember, the Democrats today had the opportunity, but it became theater. And to be fair, Republicans do this sometimes as well. Both sides do it. Of all the times I thought maybe not to do the theater, at least in one part, is on stuff that is generally agreed on by both the right and the left. You had a black senator, Tim Scott, come up there being called a symbol and a token by the like. Come on, can we not just on this?
Is he not
do that? No, he's not. I know maybe to bad faith people like you who want to argue that everything the left or the right does is somehow a contradiction to what they believe in. But you had Republicans right now were ready to say, number one, we will, because obviously the president can't go ahead and just with his executive order ban chokeholds. This does not work.
No,
incentivize.
Although, couldn't he? I don't know what the executive order. I don't know whether those powers stop.
On something like policing, this is generally believed to be on the local level. So what they essentially did was say, look, we know we can't force you, but we're going to prioritize funding to the departments that ban the chokehold, that invest in the social worker program. Again, TBD on the details. The third one, which everyone should be in support of right now, is creating a national database of cops who have a history of some kind of abuse. So they don't just go from one department to another. There's some way to track it. And the Democrats could have said, look, we don't think that this bill is perfect. But Tim Scott, who's been out there this entire time, and I think he's doing this from a good faith, and I followed kind of his career. He's just one of those guys who's just one of the few on both sides that just really believes in what he says and is just a nice dude. He's like, let's amend it. We got to get it past this and then amend it. But they didn't want to do that because they wanted to put out their own version, which presumably is going to be further to the left, which will create division. So why not say we agree on these three principles? Maybe we don't agree on the other stuff. We agree on three things. Let's pass it right now.
Because
they didn't want to give a win.
Bills don't pass with three things like that.
But right now, if your goal is to just tackle this huge issue and presumably take some baby steps, but also some significant, those three things are pretty significant. But it doesn't matter. Those are three things that there is universal agreement. And what I fear is going to happen, because the Democrats recently have done this on the House side, at least, they'll take those three things, they'll add it, and then they'll also say, no more money to a border wall, universal health care fund, like things that have nothing to do with the topic. And But it's not going to pass. So let's pass something.
It's not going to pass until they reclaim the Senate, for probably. But who knows? I mean, I feel like I think attitudes towards traditional Republican ideals, or at least the ones that Trump is putting forward, I do think that there is a shift to start to push back on anything that Trump wanted to implement. I think that there is, and what's the senator from Maine who would like tepidly attack Susan Collins, and then Lisa Murkowski. But now I'm seeing names now that are going on the record and saying this administration is causing problems. Names that I hadn't seen before. But beyond that, I don't know why we bother even to talk about the behavior of especially federally elected politicians, because their only job is to get reelected. And the only way they get reelected is to have a litany of successes. So, and they want to claim that success for them.
Yes,
their
everyone
own.
Is doing that for them.
So, yeah, this isn't a battle of idealism. This is just a battle of tactics.
No, but I mean, yeah, but it's just the same old tactics. And I feel like we're getting to the point, or at least I thought we were getting to a point where we can say, at least as an American people together, like, okay, on this one, because there's so many people who are so outraged and there's very clearly a change in thinking on this. Could you just on this one, give us a little bit of a break? And of course the answer is no.
I hate bridge the divide, Jason. I like divisive Jason.
Because I don't think there's a division on this topic, or at least on those three items. You're going to get divisions when it comes to defunding the police, because, of course, most people who hear that, regardless of whether or not they're talking about it in the way that whomever you're speaking to at the time wants to defend it, probably would say no. That's going to be in Seattle. That's going to be a big deal. But in less progressive cities, or farther to the left cities, it's just not going to work. I do think, and I think that this is a morally reprehensible position that I believe some Republicans are taking. They're seeing what's happening, for example, in Wisconsin last night. So 200 or so people in a mob essentially take over Madison, the capital of Wisconsin. They throw a Molotov cocktail into the Capitol building. They take down two statues. One of them is a statue of Hans Christian Hague, who I spent a lot of time today learning, because I did a Tucker Carlson hit on this very topic of, this is a dude who was an immigrant from Norway. He came to the United States. He was an abolitionist who died serving the Union against the Confederacy. So you've got an immigrant who's anti-slave, and you not just pull down the statue, you decapitate it, which I don't even know how they did, throw it into a river. Then they have
Bart Simpson decapitated a statue once.
He did it with a saw. And then yesterday, of course, we have Tim Carpenter, state senator from Wisconsin, Democrat, gay rights activist. He's gay himself, serving in the Senate. He's a progressive who's been a supporter of the movement. He takes out his camera. He gets beat up, given potentially a concussion, all these things. Now, presumably, they didn't know who this guy was. But what in the world are these folks doing? And I think that when you see these images, that I think the Republicans believe, and they're probably right, that if you're on the fence, let's say you don't necessarily like the tweets from Trump, but you like the economy, whatever it is, and you're kind of scared of where parts of the left are going, because there's been a vocal shift of some members on the left to go further to the left. You're saying, you know what? This is lawlessness. This is disgusting. I'm going to go with the guy who's at least right now branding himself as law and order, which is certainly not what a brand we're getting from the left.
Well, but there's no action behind it.
But that's why I find it morally reprehensible.
I don't know.
That's why I find it morally reprehensible. I think what they're saying is, or what they believe is, the more of these images are so odious to the American people, not only is it going to, again, just assure the base of the Republican Party will stand up, because no one would look at this and say, yeah, we want more of it. And then the folks down the middle are going to say, in Wisconsin, in Michigan, in Florida, okay, this is too much. This party, as much as I don't like the tweets, I like the fact that he's at least talking about putting an end to it. He's not putting an end to it. There's not. There's only so much a president can do. This is more really on the local level still, but I think they're holding back on purpose because they think it's a good win.
Perhaps. But I mean, it's funny that we're completely discounting the effects that COVID-19 is going to have on this election too. I think that, you know, you brought up they don't like Trump's tweets, but they like the economy. The economy is about to be, I believe, devastated. Like I'm really.
I thought that too, but Q2, I don't anymore.
Q1 and Q2 were essentially, they were upheld by PPP and, you know, to a lesser degree, stimulus checks. The PPP really, that kept, I mean, my dad's in a small business. He got it and it helped bridge the gap until eventually he's able to return to business as normal. Who knows when that is, but you can't keep doing that theoretically. I mean, maybe we can. I don't really know if debt is important at all anymore or not.
There's been no conversation of another. I mean,
there's no such thing as a fiscal conservative. No, that's not true. I mean, Trump started talking about another round of stimulus checks earlier.
But not a serious policy.
Not a serious, no.
Yeah, that's all I mean.
Not really, no. Andrew Yang's still talking about it a lot.
Yeah, of course. I was with you on the economic question 3 weeks ago. But the thing that's changed my mind significantly is number one, we did a story today, a new study came out that said only 47% of Americans right now feel scared about their financial situation. And they said only, even though 47% is a lot, is because they assumed it would be much, much, much worse.
I
question everything that we get on the surveys, but that's number one. Number two, I think there's a general acknowledgement, at least between us, that going into this, the economy, the fundamentals were strong.
Yeah,
the economy was buzzing along. It wasn't perfect. It's never
going to be perfect.
But
low unemployment rate, reflected by our 401ks and stuff like that. Yeah, and
really, really well. So you go into a very clear economic slowdown that was not due to the fundamentals. It was not due to a shift in any industry. Manufacturing didn't take a hit. It was shifted because the government said you cannot work. And that didn't change the fundamentals. Now, the longer you stay in that world, obviously the fundamental doesn't matter. It starts to crumble. And I think that the president or his advisors got a general sense of, once they started to say, okay, now's the time to get the economy back going, was because they saw the shift starting to happen. Last month, you have a 17% retail increase month over month. Spending was still down, or buying was still down 6%. But 17% increase in just 1 month, and the whole month wasn't even the economy reopening again. That's certainly a good sign. It could all be done next week or next month.
Right. But people started getting their pandemic unemployment. You know, you had an extra 600. That's $600 a week. That's a lot.
I know.
Unemployment started kicking in.
But retail is a little bit different than buying something that it was a necessity. Granted, retail technically covers a whole bunch of it. I know, but
country. I think what this has revealed about our economy, and I don't know if you saw, Bills Off Broadway announced it was closing today. Iconic bar in Capitol Hill has been there for 40 years. Is that we just really need to rethink our economy entirely. When you have businesses that have been institutions that were around for 40 years, suffer less than a full quarter of hardship, really, and are forced to shutter their doors entirely.
Well, I mean, to be fair, restaurant industry is especially...
It's not just restaurants, though.
I know, but yeah. I mean, the restaurant industry is, and the cruise ship industry, there's travel. Those industries are going to be especially hit hard. But I mean, you know, you look at a lot of these businesses, the reason why that they're still relatively fine, they got hit hard, but they're still going, is because a lot of people were still able to work from home and function that way. And the sooner we get back into a full strength economy or whatever the new normal looks like, I hate that term, it's going to be more telling. I don't think we're going to know about the economy in the direction probably until closer to November, which obviously the president doesn't want that to be. I'm presuming he's going to come out there and say the economy is strong. And a lot of this is just consumer confidence, which is so weird to say, but the consumer confidence, just as your perception of the economy, does change things dramatically.
It does, especially when you're thinking about voting.
Yeah, that's what I mean.
The economy. Yeah, okay. Well, I look at the Dow, which I know isn't a reflection of an economy, but let's face it, it's one of the major indicators. There's other things.
Well, people believe it to be.
People do believe it to be. You got to. All right. I'm dealing with a little kitten here.
Oh, hello, little kitten. Yeah, for people who can't see, because you're listening on the podcast, there's a little kitten.
He's chewing on my headphone cord. But the spikes in the Dow to me, it always feels like they react like such children. Like there's just whispers of something and then it's totally down good. 800 points. Yep. That we hear that hydroxychloroquine might have worked on solving COVID on one person and it spikes 1200 points. Like it's the fact that it's still around 26,000 seems insane to me, given the amount of people out of work and given the amount.
But that should tell you something about the fundamentals. Again, the one thing that I am confident with this president is his at least ability on the economy to read the room better than some.
What does that mean?
I think I trust him on his economic decisions. I question some of them, like when it comes to tariffs. But to be fair, the tariff situation actually hasn't been the disaster that people thought it would be. It hasn't been quite the success that the president thought, but it's been more successful than not. On the economy, I do trust him and his advisors more than I would some other folks. Because remember, I mean, coming into the strong economy, Obama, who was a smart dude, said we would never hit the numbers that we ended up hitting. Now, was that because of a fundamental disbelief in the power of certain sectors to come back? And was it just, I don't know. Was it ideological? I have no idea. But when you have someone who is so pro-business, and you will agree that Trump is pro-business.
Kind of. Pro is business.
He's pro-business. It goes a long way. 26,000 Dow.
And it's infuriating to me because I grew up with a kid.
This is a good point, by the way, on the screen. Thomas says the top 5% of investors are individual investors who run on news. And you know what? Like, I don't know if that stat's correct, but it can be just a small group of people who end up just saying, I'm going to sell something. And then everything all of a sudden tanks.
Well, you remember Jim Cramer explained on The Daily Show how easy it was to manipulate stock, as long as you're someone like Jim Cramer.
Remember him?
Yeah, he's still doing the same show.
I know. He was such a big thing.
Because he was the first to kind of do it, but it's like seeing Gallagher seven times.
Yeah, it's a wacky morning show, but done on CNBC.
Yeah, he would literally throw stuffed animals at the camera, like bears and bulls.
I used to watch it. It was fun.
It was kind of interesting, yeah. But Trump has screwed over so many small businesses. I think it's ridiculous to call him pro-business. I can give you literally in my town.
You're saying him as a business. Okay, yeah. But it doesn't matter. You can be pro-business as a president. Well, again, right now, the economy is doing well. People had jobs that didn't have jobs before. When you look in certain demographics that were struggling before him, whether or not you want to credit him for it, if we're going to blame any individual president for the economy tanking, you give him credit or her credit when it's doing well.
I never really do.
Well, you're then an anomaly, but you know everyone clearly does.
But people get credit. Yeah.
Last word.
If you say that, you know, Bush was responsible for the downfall in 2008, then you have to say that Trump was responsible for the 2019 economy.
And that's how voters respond usually.
Yes, it's true. If the economy is bad, except for in 84 for some reason, if the economy is bad, you're going to get voted out. I mean, look at George W. Bush's dad. That was the reason that
I'm assuming there are clear things that can happen at the time that can take us off that path. That there is a terrorist attack, God forbid, at a time where things are going poorly, but it's close to the election, and you like how the president there's stuff that can obviously impact it. But we'll see. Do you remember what I wanted to talk about?
Your TV hit? What was it?
No, although, yeah, let's just talk briefly about that. Okay. Can I say, and this is not me complaining about TV because I love it. I find it so incredibly easy and fun. And maybe part of it is because I'm still new to it in a traditional sense. Mm-hmm. But for the last 2.5 weeks I've done every single day with one exception. So, and it's been mostly chop stuff, but it's also today, for example, we talked about Wisconsin. It's also very stressing when you get the call at the last minute, when you do a radio show that you have to tape out like the last half hour. Mm. So today I left at 5:15 to get there for a hit that I thought was going to be at 5:52. So they were going to basically wrap the show with it. 5 o'clock comes and the camera guy sends me a text. Are you here? Are you coming? I've never panicked so much in my life. Because immediately you're like, oh my God, what do you mean? Am I coming? Yes, right. I'm going to be there. I don't leave for another 15 minutes.
Yeah.
I check, then I pan, and then I've got 2 minutes. So I'm about to go live on the radio. So I'm panic checking email to find the time that I'm supposed to do it. And then while it wasn't immediate, I very clearly didn't look at the email because they changed the time from what I thought it was going to be to 5:40, which is just a huge panic. So 5:15 comes, I bolt out of the studio, grab my jacket, put my makeup on in the car as I'm going in. We get onto I-5, a ton of traffic.
Of course.
There has not been traffic on I-5 for the last 3 months. Mm-hmm. But of course there's traffic. Now, God bless this woman who's the driver, who I'm like, look, I need you to cheat. I will not tell your boss. You just floor it. She floored it. And I was
really
so uncomfortable.
I've always wanted to tell a driver to do that.
Yeah, she floored it in a reasonable way given the amount of traffic.
Yeah.
But she was going in and out of the lanes, and I got there with plenty of time. And I was like, okay, good. I have 15, 20 minutes almost to spare. They pushed the time to 45. I'm like, okay. So I get in, put my jacket on, doing some of the touch up of the makeup, blah, blah, blah. We're going into a break. I'm on in 4 minutes. Guess what happens? The camera completely freezes. Not our camera on our end, but the satellite. Something mm-hmm. happened where it froze. And immediately the producer's in my ear is like, can you still hear me? I go, yes, you're frozen. And I see the cameraman is panic dialing in a controlled way. To me, it's panic.
Mm-hmm.
They restored the camera with maybe 30 seconds to go. And all of the stress that I had going in just came back. It ended up, I thought, being a really good hit. And I didn't feel the stress when I was actually on it.
Right.
And again, I think it's not that I
know, like, because if we on radio, if something just falls through, you just fill. TV, yeah, after a while, TV guys, they can't fill anymore. Like they'll just panic if they go to someone, because I've been watching more cable news, and with, you know, Zoom isn't as good as having someone there in studio. If someone's sitting in front of you, you know, they're going to be there. So there's been Zoom outages, and I'll just see Don Lemon just stare straight ahead and be like,
"That is so bad."
He's just not. Don and Chris Cuomo are just objectively, topics aside, whatever, not very good at their job. 100%
agree. I 100%.
I watched an hour of Don Lemon, who I find like amiable and likable. I mean, he drunkenly got his nipple pierced on New Year's Eve a couple of years
ago. So edgy.
I don't know how do you go back to being like respected broadcaster, but whatever.
Well, Anderson Cooper has been playing that role for a bit. Where
true.
He does the goofy stuff on New Year's, but he's still deemed a serious journalist. He
kept his shirt on, you know, normally. But Don Lemon had all these different medical experts on, and I wanted to watch because a guy that I've actually interviewed before from UW was on. And his first question is, should states be concerned? Should the states that are seeing spikes in the coronavirus, should they be concerned? Like how? And I thought the only living, semi-living entity that would say no is literally the coronavirus.
there's context, though, to a question like that. For example, here, just based on what you just said. Yeah, totally. But right. I'll be the one who can do it better. I would say, given there's a surge in cases while we also have an increase in testing, should we look at these numbers and be concerned? Or is it just a natural inclination? Or is it going up simply because we're doing the testing and the death rate is still low? Like you can give context to that.
Or should they be worried because hospital capacity is starting?
There's so many places to give context.
And I know you don't watch sports that often, but and I don't know if
I watch soccer every night. EPL is back.
American sports. But no matter how long someone has been a post-game reporter, when they interview the quarterback, the point guard after a big victory, the question is, how does it feel? And it's been the same answer for 50 years. No one, because there's no other answer. It feels great. I just won the NBA championship.
Don't you want one time someone to just say, it feels awful. I was planning on throwing this game and winning a huge bet, and right. I just screwed it up. No matter what I did, the other team sucked too much.
Now, I did want to point out, too, that Don Lemon last night asked this question no less than four times to four different guests. And of varying Zoom qualities, too. I feel like if you're going to have, like, mine's B-. Mine's still way better than most of the CNN guests, where it almost looks like footage from the Ring video.
But you know why? I think because a lot of them, especially now, we're not talking about the contributors. We're talking about guests that are just doing more now because they're doctors.
Absolutely.
They're also older generally.
Yes.
And you assume they don't quite have the technology acumen as someone who's in their 40s or below. You're a 72-year-old doctor from New York City, Langone. I'm assuming you don't have a great grasp on the technology beyond what you need to do for your
job. All of this is true, but CNN could do something about that. If you're going to have someone on, you could definitely provide them with a better equipment, or at least give them a tutorial on what to do when Don asks you a question, it's just remarkable. Like this show that we're doing right now, in it's some way, it is as
shows. I've done maybe three or four, like a handful of Skype interviews with Fox,
mm-hmm.
and there really isn't any guidance. They'll connect a little bit early and they'll do a quick test, and they do say, make sure you've got an earbud in instead of just the speakers open because it causes some feedback. And they'll say, hey, if you can just, lift your camera up a little bit or move your chair down so we can frame you. That's about it.
Yeah.
And you are kind of the victim of the circumstances at the time with your ISP. Like if your internet is just happens to be not going so well, then it's not going so well. And there's no real way around it. At least 3 months ago, there was no way around it. If you're still in the role of doing this, and things for the most part are starting to open up, because I'm seeing a lot more, at least on the Fox side, I'm seeing more guests go into studios.
Mm-hmm.
It's not going to be that big of a deal. But when you're not expecting that kind of thing, it is kind of hard to continue a 24-hour news channel, whether it's Fox or CNN or MSNBC or whoever,
right.
and not run into these occasional problems. I just think it seems worse because number one, we're more aware of it now because it never happened before. And we have a certain expectation on the quality, because I'm assuming my camera looks good right now because I have a brand new Surface. It's a new Surface laptop. Yeah. Yours is not.
It's okay. Which is weird. This is a brand new Mac PC. I would think that the camera would be better. I'm somewhat disappointed because the camera on my iPhone is better than this one.
Yeah, the new iPhone camera is actually really good. But so, for example, people who are listening on the podcast can't tell, but I've got a light on in the background. This I purchased because I was doing some Skype hits. Cost like $30 on Amazon. This is one feed. This is another one. I have no idea which one looks better or not. And sometimes they'll just be like, hey, does this look or this one? And they'll just say, oh, yeah, that's fine.
Not that one. Yeah.
This is the natural one.
That one's probably the best, actually. Hi, sweetheart.
He's talking to us. So that wasn't to me. I found the topic that I was going to ask you wanted to talk about. You and I off camera were talking about Mel Gibson.
Oh,
and
yeah.
Whether or not, because you asked me, I think was, did you know that Mel Gibson was an anti-Semite?
Which I was doing sarcastically.
Yes.
Yeah.
But it did get me questioning, because the way that you said a Variety story came out, essentially Winona Ryder accused Mel Gibson of making anti-Semitic and homophobic remarks, according to Variety. I haven't clicked the story. I don't care.
Yeah.
But you jokingly said that because in the story, it made it sound like this was news to people that he has a history of being. I've not heard the homophobic stuff in the past, or I'm assuming. I guess I'm not surprised. I've not heard that.
No,
I've heard of the anti-Semitic stuff. And then I got to thinking of there's a generation of younger viewers who, number one, probably don't even know who Mel Gibson is. And number two, as a result, don't realize he is an anti-Semite.
Yeah, I guess it was a longer ago than I realized when the Radar Online, this was like their big scoop, which I don't even think Radar exists anymore, TMZ type site. So they get a hold of all these tapes of Mel Gibson, I'm assuming drunkenly calling and berating his wife. I'm
pretty and sure.
Before that, he had gotten pulled over by the police and said a bunch of anti-Semitic
don't
stuff.
Don't say it on the.
I'm not going to say it. And I can't. I'm not even going to.
Sugar bleep was also even, one of them.
Exactly. I'm not even going to use the initials for the stuff that he said on the tape. But it was like he was outcast from Hollywood for a while until. I mean, he made a couple of things, but Hacksaw Ridge was sort of his reintegration.
But no one saw it.
But it got nominated for six Oscars.
Yeah, that's true. It was critically received.
It's very good. And then
is that with what's his name? Spider-Man?
Andrew Garfield.
I hated that movie so much.
How could you hate Hacksaw Ridge?
I hated it. I just did not like it. I found it so hokey. And to be fair, I don't generally like war movies, to be fair. Right. Although I loved 1917, I think was my number two of last year.
It was good. I mean, it was cool style. And then he was in Daddy's Home too, which is become a Christmas tradition because it's hysterical.
I still have not seen it. It's on my list.
It seemed really weird. So the genesis of the article was Winona Ryder was talking about some of the things that Mel Gibson said in her presence back a long, long, long time ago. But it was like, at this point, it's like if you convicting a dictator of genocide and then also like 10 years later, bringing up the fact that he had a lot of parking tickets too. Like the stuff that it's been well established that Mel Gibson has long been anti-Semitic and said horrific, horrific.
And things. Racist, and just and a racist, whole list of things.
Like there's one sentence that I'm only going to think of in my mind.
Yeah, don't say
that. He says to his wife, that's like maybe the most racist seven words ever put together. Yes. And he screams it.
at her. Oh, but he was drunk. So okay,
it was just, right.
That makes a difference.
It felt just like a really, really odd piece, I guess. But
again, there are younger people. You think a 22-year-old knows who Mel Gibson is? Maybe they've got some reference to like Lethal Weapon or something. But his last movie, and even that one, what's it called? Ridge. What's it called?
Hacksaw Ridge.
Hacksaw Ridge.
He directed it.
So he wasn't even in it. So it's not like you can go back and say, oh, he had that iconic role.
You don't think Generation Z, or what are they called? Who's the generation below millennials?
Z.
Yeah. You don't think they like Bird on a Wire?
Yeah, I don't think
they're Netflix and Bird on a Wire.
There is, I guess, I don't know if Braveheart is obviously considered a classic film, but I don't know if it's like, pop culturally a cultural classic, right?
I think that if you liked it when it came out, you'll rewatch it or you own like a Criterion collection. But I don't think it's anything anyone ever searches out.
People don't talk about it the way they talk about like The Godfather or something. They don't say Braveheart as you have to see this movie.
Everyone needs to see it. I think it's lousy.
Although Braveheart was. I didn't love Braveheart.
I know that. And then the thing is too, it's like Scotland's still trash. So you won. I mean, Scotland became modern day Scotland looks like train spotting. All these people sacrificed their lives so Scotland could just raise a generation of heroin addicts eventually.
He's been in clearly iconic roles that I don't think, and I'm wondering if because of the anti-Semitism and the racism, it's kind of being held down. Like Mad Max as a character should probably be much bigger right now culturally as a pop cultural item than it is. Same thing with, I mean, what is it? Murtaugh? Was that his name?
Murtaugh, or
is that
Danny
Glover? Yeah. Lethal Weapon. Of a certain generation, people know what that is, and they've seen that.
Five insanely popular movies. It was a juggernaut.
He's an A-list, or he was an A-lister. He was Tom Cruise level of Leo DiCaprio. He was huge. And even some of his lesser known movies, like Ransom, I remember really liking Ransom.
They were hits. Everything was a hit. He directed Passion of the Christ, which for a while was. Highest grossing rated R film of all time, I think.
Are you sure he did Hacksaw Ridge and not, you're not thinking of We Were Soldiers?
I'm positive.
Okay, because he was in We Were Soldiers, but he didn't, okay.
Yeah, he did, well, he did
I'm
not
just on his IMDb. He was in We Were Soldiers and that sucked.
Yeah. They made Apocalypto, which was a huge hit. And he was
did you see Apocalypto? I refuse because everyone tells me it's like the most graphic movie they've ever seen.
It's pretty brutal. But Passion of the Christ, I think, is probably the most graphic movie I've ever seen. And he directed both. And apparently he was Jim Caviezel, who played Jesus in Passion of the Christ, said Mel Gibson planning a sequel for real. I don't know if Jim Caviezel
that should not be
really
true.
Hopeful.
That's not true.
Caviezel doesn't strike me as someone who jokes about this sort of stuff. Now he might be might be wishful thinking because his career has tanked since then.
Oh no, I'm sorry. I take that back. It's called The Passion of the Christ Resurrection. It's in pre-production for 2020. What would the move? What would, huh?
It's Resurrection.
Okay. No, I mean, yeah, it's Resurrection, but I mean, it's a little, okay.
I don't know much about his Resurrection. So I mean, he got resurrected.
I mean, I know that it came 3 days between the crucifixion. Oh, no, this is, they're doing the 3 days between the crucifixion and his resurrection.
Okay.
I'm a Jew here. I know the stuff sort of, but not all the details.
Right. I don't either. I don't know much about those 3 days. I thought his body was like in a cave, and then they went and looked in the cave, and his body
wasn't there anymore. That's kind of all I know as well. I mean, I suppose it could, at least it'll be less violent.
I can't imagine it being more violent. It's literally like a 2-hour beating.
Jim Caviezel's, he's signed up, at least on the IMDb.
Yeah. I mean, who else? You can't recast at this point.
I mean, of course you can. I mean, you can just get someone who... makeup, you can make them look like it.
I suppose, but
I've got an IMDb page got an IMDb page and I'm not updating it myself. And I don't know who's updating it.
What have you been in? This?
Every time I do a Fox News hit, it's up there.
I didn't think that kind of stuff was put on.
I didn't think so either, but I got an alert because I do a Google alert in case my name shows up in a story or something. Mm-hmm. And they sent me the IMDb page, and it only came in once. So now I just go, and I'm just kind of curious. And I saw yesterday, not only did they update it without me having to do anything, they have me, I guess they preemptively booked me on Fox and Friends for June 28th because it shows up as I'm on June 28th of 2020.
Doesn't this terrify you a little bit?
I'm terrified. It's so weird. It is just kind of weird.
Is out there.
I mean, maybe
your IMDb.
But maybe the service, maybe they just automatically like pull metadata from something that's online is my guess.
That has to be it.
Because I don't know what happens on the back end of any of these. It's not like you've got normal credits coming up on these shows. So I don't know
how anyone
finds out. I know you can, and I think you can update it yourself. And I kind of just want to delete the one that's fake, but not really because it just pads my credits.
Yeah. But what's it really doing for you other than
nothing?
Yeah.
It just makes, you know what it does? Because sometimes I'm like, I am kind of curious about how many times I've been on just to track the progress, I guess. Mm. And so right now it shows, and already it has today's up there. Again,
this has somehow.
It's got to be some automation kind of
thing. I don't know where would they get the data from? Do they get like show rundowns or something? So it's not like at the end guest starring Jason Rands. Like it's that is weird.
I've been on. Any guesses how many times I've been on Tucker?
I don't know. All of the times.
30.
You've been in Tucker 30.
Isn't that a lot? Doesn't that seem like a lot? Wisconsin
version of you? Like, why did they have to come to the Pacific Northwest to talk about the Midwest?
Well, we did an update on CHOP. I've been the official CHOP correspondent.
Of course.
Let's talk briefly then about the public library, because I can't remember if I told you. So at one point, and I can't remember when, but Tucker turned CHOP into a parody. It's rife for humor just because of the way that it was set up. And at the time, obviously there wasn't the kind of violence that was leading to death. So you can have a little fun with it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when I thought I did the best, because I just generally have a more snarky sense of humor, and I'm not like the, here are the facts, ma'am. And so we did it by the library for two reasons. Number one, it just was not safe for Fox people to be at the CHOP. They were harassing our camera crew, and I was accused of making it up, like, oh, you've never even been in there. No, I've been in there. We don't go with the cameraman, because the second that happens, we get harassed. And the camera guy was getting harassed. And the one day that we did it offsite in downtown was we just didn't have security that day, and we just playing it safe. So it was purposefully picked as a spot, as a joke, to play into we're in the demilitarized zone. It's at the border. It literally was meant to be a joke. And I tweeted out the photo, and I thought I was jokingly saying we were in the demilitarized zone. People were like, hey, idiot, it's in downtown Seattle. Who are you trying to fool? And I couldn't, for like 3 hours, I couldn't figure out what was going on, like why people were taking this seriously. And they weren't people who were following me. They were people who just, like, the CHOP was in the tweet, and CHOP was trending, so people just clicked on it. And I was like, are you not even – I literally joked in the segment about a dodgeball Olympic team. So no reasonable person could look at this and think it was serious. I had made a mistake. I did not create a thread. It was just two individual tweets. And so for someone who didn't click on the profile and see the other tweet with the video that clearly identifies it as parody, thought I was being serious. And man, was I getting dragged for like 24 hours.
Yeah.
Nonstop. There were so many tweets, just like me. And then some of them I tried to respond, which always is a mistake. You can't respond to any of these. They're all insane. I'm like, it's clearly a parody, and I try. And then someone was like,
"Do you understand though why there would be a little confusing?" Because
yeah, I totally. I thought the context made it clear, but there was no context because I thought I had done it as a thread, and I didn't.
Mm-hmm.
And so fine. But even the people who I said it was a parody to, they're like, no, it's not. You're lying, and you got caught. I'm like, no, here's the video. Literally, look at the video. You dumb.
So did you do it in front of the library? Was that purpose? Because you could have done a live shot in it front. There's a million buildings in Seattle that look like buildings in Capitol Hill.
I thought it was done as a joke. I literally thought that they were playing into it. And the content of how we set it up was, we were at the border of the neighborhood of CHOP. Like, it was very clearly
defined. It's not clear. The satire is not clear.
Here's the satire was very clear in the context of of doing it. Here's another example. Although this was a mistake on my part. I'm owning this one. Although in retrospect, it worked out. So last Friday, as all the statues were being torn down, I was like, hey. Because they didn't want to do it at the CHOP again, because it was getting really bad at that point for the staff. I said, we got a Lenin statue. Why don't we just shoot it outside of the Lenin statue, and we can make just point it out? Because Tucker made the point tonight of like, he doesn't care if their statues are up. At this point, it's just like, how about we have a conversation rather than decapitating them? And I'm the same opinion. If it's a Confederate statue, I have no passion whatsoever about any statue. I just don't care.
I don't really.
But clearly we can't have a bunch of people just tearing things down and defacing. You just can't have that. Right. So we do it. We did it at the Lenin statue. I thought Tucker was going to bring it up by himself. Apparently I was supposed to bring it up, and I did not realize that. So we just did it. We didn't mention it once. It was just, it was just in the background. And then it started to trend on Twitter. It trended on Twitter because James Woods tweeted out the shot. Mm-hmm. And this was just kismet, as my people would say, a happy coincidence, because people thought we purposefully didn't say anything to make the point of it standing behind me. Mm-hmm. And so it actually was weird. It worked, although that was I didn't realize I was supposed to be the one to bring it up. That was my
right.
Bad.
Yeah.
But someone said I am
more weirdly poignant. Yeah, for you actually not to bring it up.
People were like, "Why didn't you bring it up?" I'm like, I thought he was, and I didn't realize the time. And by the way, doing outside hits like that, especially that one, mm-hmm. that one was, it wasn't hard, but it was more distracting because you literally have a busy street by where people are walking by.
That's a major intersection. Yeah.
And so the other ones, we were doing it in a place where it was more private, so random people weren't just walking by. Mm-hmm. Someone says IMDb is based right here in Seattle, and maybe that, I don't think that's the reason why I'm added, but is IMDb local? I didn't know that.
Cares. I hate the way when people say, you do know that IMDb is here, right? Like, you have one fact. That's your one stupid fact. You've been waiting.
I learned something. That's interesting to me.
Dude, what would it matter if they were here or if they were in
maybe they're Orlando? Fans at this point. And no, they're the ones adding me. Everyone loves me except the gross amount of people who hate me.
I don't think that there's a big camp in either crowd. I think that you just have 1,400 bitter
Tucker Carlson, number one cable show.
Cable news show, right. Again, bitter octogenarians who
everyone loves
them. I bet there's maybe three people that consume your media that are under the age of 40.
That is demonstrably untrue. Thank you. How's your podcast going? Give it a plug or video cast. What are we calling it?
Burns and Holla. So I'm Zach Burns. Terry Holloman goes by T. Holla. And it certainly sounds a lot better than Zach and Terry.
That's true.
That's it's going well so far. We had Amanda Knox on just this past Monday just to talk about prison reform. Obviously, she's somewhat of an expert on that. She's not an expert on reform.
She's an expert of what it's like.
Well, what it's like when there's
and why it should be reformed, perhaps.
Exactly. And I would actually deem her an expert because she's dedicated her life to studying it since being.
Is that what she's doing now? Isn't she? Didn't I see something like she's doing journalism for some like community paper? Am I making that up?
Yeah. I think that was a rumor. I don't think that was actually true.
Theater review for like the Mukilteo Beacon or something like, or the West Seattle something or other.
I think that's where she calls home. But it's like, I think a lot of people assume because like she's pretty famous and had like a Netflix documentary made about her that she's supremely wealthy. So like many of us, she's just kind of cobbling any work that she can. It's just she does a podcast. She does
to be. I don't find her to be familiar looking. Like when I see her, I don't say, "Oh, that's Amanda Knox." I'm like, "Oh, okay, that's Amanda Knox."
Yeah, that's like, it's
picture her.
Right, right. I think the name. Yeah, the name is more famous.
Yeah,
not someone who gets recognized.
Yeah, she's at the Whole Foods. I'm not pointing. It's like, "Oh, that's Amanda Knox."
Right, right, exactly. Yeah. But internationally, I think that she has more fame than she does here. Yeah, and then next week, guess who we're having on?
Not me.
John O'Neill.
Really?
Formerly the Ron and Don Show. Yeah. That'll be fun. I like the good thing about that is that when you have another talk show host on, it's far less work for you. You don't have to fill. You don't really have to worry about the pacing as much.
Can we just acknowledge how easy it is to co-host a show?
So easy.
It was. What's so annoying in a good way, in a positive way, but it is somewhat annoying. When you and I were doing a show together, I'm someone who's – I show prep, man. I do show prep. I like to plot out where I want to go and how I want to get – like that's – but then with you, I very quickly realized there's no point in it because we were going to do show prep together, which I didn't want to because I thought part of it.
That's weird.
We didn't do that. With the general sound, I mean, you knew my take and I knew your take for the most part, but that was it.
Yeah.
And we knew like the kind of audio we had to use. Mm-hmm. But for that 3-hour show, which I would normally say if every single segment was afresh, you're not rehashing any past stories and I'm doing it solo, that would take me about at the time, probably 2.5 to 3 hours. Now, when I'm doing a solo, it's much easier because it's whatever. With you, maybe it was 20 minutes that I would, like, legit show prep. It was just basically how long would it take for me to read the story and know what it's about.
Yeah.
And half the time you're talking about stories that are building upon a story we did yesterday or last week. And, you know, the West Seattle Bridge is coming up. What are we going to do? Like, it was so easy.
So easy. Anyone who tells you that it's a hard job is just either they have a really bad co-host, which I would imagine would make it more difficult, for sure. Where you feel like
you can sabotage, like I could sabotage you, and you could sabotage me by simply not engaging or not like taking cues or the rules of improv of don't say no, but you say and yes and or yes and.
And it's funny. I only during my time at Cairo, I only co-hosted with one person who actually would just kind of put the kibosh on conversations just by doing what you said.
Oh, really?
No, I'm not. I don't know about that story. I don't know about this person. Like, which is, you want to just tear their throat out at that point.
It is kind of difficult when you're in a position like that. It is 100%. And sometimes, to be fair, not everyone realizes that they're doing it. Sometimes they do. And I think you and I don't think you've ever purposefully sabotaged, like with a nefarious intent, maybe with like a funny intent.
I wouldn't do it. Be like, I don't want to do this story and then just sit there.
Yeah. Like that. Shut up, Jason. Cause to be fair, I would have not wanted it because then I could just monologue for 20 minutes.
And then I should have let you take more SDOT segments because I could not be less interested in the Seattle Department of Transportation. And I feel like every night it was like, all right, so we're going to lead with SDOT. Like, damn it.
That was my beat. And now my beat is more cop issues and homelessness, less homelessness now because of the coronavirus, but it's still, my beat has weirdly become, not weirdly, I mean, it's by, it's intentional, but I mean, no at some point, brand.
Transportation issues aren't really like.
Yeah, but even now I don't really do transportation, not the same style, not for KTTH, because it's a completely different audience.
Yeah.
And when I talk transportation on KTTH, it's more highway kind of stuff. Like, seriously, I-5, we're not doing any like that, or tolls, which I think is still a hot topic, especially if you have to pay them.
Yeah.
It's gonna and plus, there was at a time, at least in Seattle, like the reason why they were stories was they were redefining their transportation model. In Seattle, they were actively like 5-6 years ago. They said purposely, we're going to get rid of lanes and do more bus only and do more bike lanes and spend the money there. Mm-hmm. And so that's why. I mean, if there they do that now, it what?
There was the Sound Transit bill that passed.
Yeah, ST3. There was some more context there that made it more of a story. Whereas and now, it, not
how
really.
Much do you miss? What was that council member's name? He would always wear sandals. It was like infuriating.
Oh, Mike O'Brien.
God, how did I forget that?
He's
already?
The worst.
You remember we had that clip where it was.
You should. It should. About it shouldn't man. Be. It shouldn't be wandering, walking to the grocery store in a war zone where you're just getting hit by cars left and right. It was something so outrageously hyperbolic.
It made him sound. Like he was describing like an embedded reporter in Iraq.
Yes.
Or actually just a literal soldier in Iraq. Like that it was
so weird.
I think the table was actually walking to Starbucks that you were.
Yeah, it was walking to Starbucks. You shouldn't have to put your life on the line simply walking to Starbucks. And we were like, I walk to Starbucks every single day. There's one 5 blocks away. I've never gotten hit by a car. What are you talking about?
It would be an absurd set of circumstances for you to be hit by a car on your way to Starbucks. You would be
hit by a car in Seattle.
Yeah. Yeah.
There's so few places where, at least in Seattle Central, where you can even speed to get hit by it because there's so much traffic.
Although we do both know someone who got hit by a car in Seattle.
That was a truck or a bus, wasn't it?
It was a truck. It was a pickup truck. But, those are cars.
He actively tried to get hit almost.
It's seemingly so. Because the days following when we found out he was going to be okay and everything, I started thinking, how did a grown up get hit by a car?
He wasn't paying attention.
Because even in a rather sleepy neighborhood of Seattle as well.
No, I mean, this particular block at about, I don't remember what time it happened, but I mean, because there's not a lot of traffic at the time, you're speeding down there, and if you're not looking,
speeding
you can
at 40, I get, yeah. But I spent 4 days just ignoring don't walk signs, just seeing if like there would even be any near misses. And
you ran in front of a car, and each time they politely stopped and said, "I almost hit you. Please continue. Sorry." Yeah. Were you with me when we went to the Uber meeting in Seattle, and Mike O'Brien showed up and sat right next to me, and I was trying to get the selfie him without him noticing, because I think that's where we got the he's wearing shorts and sandals. Oh my God, what's wrong with him?
I know.
And if I recall, he was wearing socks with those sandals.
He seems like a sock and sandal guy.
Yeah, which
shout it out.
No, don't do that. Yeah, no. Don't do that.
Don't wear socks.
You don't wear sandals, period. Just but don't. You don't wear socks. Well, look, you can wear sandals if you're literally at the beach. I will give you a pass. Or if you've got like those sandal kind of loafers where you're just wandering out to the front porch and grabbing the newspaper. Okay, fine. I'll give you that. But that's
a slipper situation.
Not slipper. Everyone has slippers. Slippers? Who has slippers?
I don't know.
Do people still have slippers? That seems like a bygone era of like 50s dads.
Like the, because they would go with your robe. Like men used to come home.
And who has robes anymore?
Put on a robe. He would come home and change out of his work clothes and just put on a robe.
That's weird, right?
That's a crazy thing to do. And then just spend the rest of the night in the robe.
Is it not hot? You're warm. And by the way, you're wearing a shirt and pants or shorts underneath it. Why do you need the robe?
No. He would disrobe.
He was naked? Oh, really? He'd
be naked under the robe.
Oh, that's especially weird.
It is. But most men, when they came home and put on the robe, I don't think that they would get fully naked, but they would have the wife beater underwear. Why?
The only way you can justify, I think, a robe is, again, you're quickly going out to get the newspaper and you don't want to get dry.
Yeah.
Okay, that's fair. But
or luxurious. Like there's robes if you say it like, you know, a St. Regis or something. Yeah. You just lounge around in the robes, but that's like special occasion robe, not weird nightly robe.
So I've done that before where I was like, after it, I was like, you know what? I can get used to this. And I bought a robe that I've literally never worn it.
No, I feel great.
I've never put it on.
Outside of the hotel.
It's just hanging in my bathroom. by the way, we're now a month and a half in, by the way, into my MyPillow towel. Best towel ever.
I can't believe
it's an amazing towel. I swear to God.
Because I hated his pillow.
I like his pillow. But I can see why people might not like my pillow. Yeah. It is. I really liked it. But also, I'm a back sleeper. And I think that plays a little bit of a role in how it's designed. But the towel is so great. It's ridiculous.
Are you endorsing them now? Or did you just buy one?
No, I'm not. I'm getting nothing for this. I legitimately love their towel.
That dude is so bonkers. I
like him. He's a good dude.
I was a former crack addict. Like now,
he owns it. He just owns it, and I like that. Good for him.
I guess. And then don't you get? I think if you buy something, don't you get like a free copy of his book where he talks about
journey
from crack addict to pillow mogul?
Yeah, something like that. Good for him. Whatever. Good for him.
He doesn't really.
So when am I going to be a guest on your show?
I don't know. TBD. At some point. Kind of booked out for the next month.
You went to Don before me.
Yeah. Because
Maybe we won't do this anymore. Maybe I'm going to wait until I get it. Don't pretend you don't text me constantly about doing this. Don't pretend you don't send me a note every day saying, how about tonight? Can we?
I text you as often as I obsessively insult Erica, which is not very often.
We text almost daily.
We do, but it's rarely show stuff. And then let's talk about old man Rant's text last night. I am getting forgetful. You couldn't remember
John Cusack texting. I pictured him. I remembered some of the movies that I absolutely hate that he's been in.
Yeah.
And I could picture it. I just couldn't remember his name. And it was like on the tip of my tongue. And all I needed was you to say Joan's brother.
Right.
And immediately I knew. Immediately I was like, oh, yeah, it's John Cusack. I just
needed that little bit of a nudge. High fidelity guy, isn't it, right?
What was the name of the movie in which he was in a motel and it turned out all to be in the guy's head? that wasn't real. That was the one of the room 808 or 880, something like that.
Yeah.
One of the worst movies I've ever seen. Not only because just the movie's bad, but the whole movie is based on characters made up in a crazy person's head.
Yeah.
And you learn that before the conclusion to the movie.
Yeah.
To the character, which means, what do you care? It's fake.
It's all
none of this is real.
He's in a movie. Samuel Jackson's in it too. It's called Cell. It's just everyone gets turned into zombies because of cell phone towers. But it literally, they show three different endings at the end. One where he like escapes to, you know, there's always like this utopian camp in post-apocalyptic zombie world.
It's Chop.
He makes it there with his daughter. Another one, he dies. And then a third one, he becomes a zombie. They just play them all back to back to back. And they never tell you like which one is. It's like, here's all the endings and you choose. But we were talking about it because he played Brian Wilson, former singer of the Beach Boys, in a movie called Love and Mercy, which was, I've not been so surprised by how good a movie was in quite a long time, thinking that John Cusack doesn't really do characters. Like, he's always kind of himself. It was really good.
Doesn't seem like somebody who has range.
No, he doesn't really have range. And they tried to make him an action star in 2012. I think it was the end of the world movie. But he had his great movies. One Crazy
Summer.
That
movie wasn't awful. I mean, that was a good movie for the genre.
Horrendous.
But for the genre, it's a good bad movie.
You got to have buy-in on the hero, right? Like, if The Rock was in that movie,
I weirdly like 2012.
We're just going to have to not agree on that one.
What's better? 2012, Deep Impact, Armageddon, or the end of the weather movie with Roland Emmerich as the director? That one.
God, now we're both in the same boat.
So you got four. What's the best one?
The day after tomorrow.
Okay, what's number four?
Armageddon
of the four.
Far the best one.
Armageddon, agreed. A close two that I feel people forget because it came out at the same time. Deep Impact is actually pretty good. I like Deep Impact.
It's insanely similar plots.
It's almost the same.
Yeah, it's about a meteor.
Except everyone dies basically at the end of the movies.
Do they? I didn't remember that.
Yeah, it hit. I mean, they
did actually
blah, blah, blah.
Yeah. Right.
Okay. And Elijah Wood and his girlfriend, the neighbor, they managed to get to the top of a hill that wasn't impacted.
Right.
And Morgan Freeman survived, but then Tia Leone dies with her dad, who she had a bad relationship with.
Oh, that's too bad. I'm okay with that, though.
Spoiler alert.
Yeah, in Armageddon, Bruce Willis dies. And I think
that was a good movie, though. It's too long, but it's a good movie.
Yeah, but okay. The one time, this is another pot story. But when I went and saw it in a theater with my friend Steve Rauscher, who, by the way, snuck two Big Macs into a movie theater.
Oh.
And you can't smell a Big Mac if you're eating one at McDonald's. But if you bring one into a movie theater, that movie theater smelled like Big Macs in like 30 seconds. But he was high. And if you remember that scene where Bruce Willis decides he's going to sacrifice himself and he cuts off transmission back to Earth because he's on the meteor out in space. And his daughter, played by Liv Tyler, does this, like puts her hand on a screen as it turns to fuzz. My friend Steve starts bawling. Like, uncontrollably, you know, like not even, because I saw Up in the theater and it got to the point where I was tearing up, like, so it streamed
out. Everyone teared up at that.
Yeah, exactly. He is bawling, like almost like an Italian widow.
That's amazing.
It's humiliating because everyone's somewhat moved by the moment, but now all the attention has been focused on the tears coming from where the Big Mac smell is.
You were with me during the final Avengers, where the woman next to me, or maybe like two seats over, was just flat out bawling when Tony Stark dies. Like embarrassing, sloppy.
It was ridiculous.
Legit sloppy cry.
Yeah, it was
snot. You could hear the snot. That's how sloppy it was.
The kind that like you form little bubbles. She had the bubbles. Yeah.
I got emotional towards the, I didn't cry, but I got emotional towards the end. It was with Spider-Man and him at the, like, Stark, Mr. Stark.
Mm-hmm.
Like the little innocence between him and the guy who's become the father figure. That was the one time I got a little choked up.
Yeah. But it was not worth what that woman was putting herself through.
Oh no. That was just, I'm like, ma'am, you need to leave.
Exactly.
Did you see they're not opening, or did I think we talked about that. Cinerama is not opening again.
Yeah.
I have never been more okay with a movie theater not opening. The Cinerama was always the promise of something that it could have been, with a great screen, great audio. You go to the bathroom, it's playing, so you don't really miss anything. But those seats are the most uncomfortable seats I've ever sat in, because there's no give. You have to fall all the way back.
Mm-hmm.
It's like a rocking chair that go no matter what. I don't want to go all the way back. I want to sit up straight. And so it forces you into the worst posture. And it just hurts at some point.
My hope is that now someone else will try to do like a theater like Cinerama and do it better. When I lived in Kansas City, there's a place called the Alamo Draft House, and it's by far the best theater I've ever had. And the closest thing Seattle had was, or the Living Room Theater in Portland is pretty great.
Don't they have, what's the one underneath that restaurant on 3rd or 2nd?
Restaurant.
Big Picture?
I don't know.
Is that what it's called? And there's one in Montlake Terrace, Cinnabar, I think it is. Like it's supposed to be. I've never actually been to it.
It might as well be in Spokane for me. That sounds so far.
Montlake Terrace is 15, 20 minutes.
There's a few businesses that I truly, truly love here that I am really worried about how they're going to get through, because they are restaurants. And even that, now that we're in phase 1.5, 25% capacity.
No, we're in phase 2 now.
Phase 2.
Oh, by the way, it's called Big Picture. It's under the El Gacho.
Oh, that's right. Okay. I just feel like we're going to see a lot more.
Which ones do you think are going to go?
There's the Eastlake Zoo, which is really close to me. They had their rent jacked by 200% last year. I don't know what sort of deal they had with their landlords during the pandemic. But
what's the burger place that's two blocks away from there? It's really good.
Yeah, the Otter Bar and Burger.
Otter Bar, really, really good.
It is
really
good. It's great. Yeah. They're really, really nice people. They live in the neighborhood.
I talked to the owner.
Yeah. Really, really nice people. I don't know. Just when you see companies that have been around for 80 years still just like announcing massive layoffs, like there's no way those 125,000 people from Macy's are going to go back to Macy's. Like that's just not going to happen after all those layoffs. So I try to end every podcast with despair, because that's how I end all of my days.
Yeah. So, I mean, you just reflect on your life and where it is at this point. Yeah.
So I figured, why not finish this on a down note?
Okay, well then I'll slightly less down note. I saw the movie Irresistible, the new John.
Oh yeah,
Stewart movie.
Yeah,
it is awful. It is a political movie that should be in his wheelhouse. It should be clever. Nothing. It's got the worst twist ending of any movie. It's so horrifically bad. Mm-hmm. And I'm so disappointed, because I actually like Steve Carell. I love Rose Byrne, who I think is hysterical. She's so good. This movie is lifeless. It is so awful.
That's kind of what I've been hearing about it.
Yeah, it's super disappointing.
It doesn't surprise me. A lot of people that are hysterically funny when they go and try to direct.
But didn't he do a movie that was well received, John Stewart?
Rosewater, which was
I didn't see it.
It was fine. It was it was good subject matter, but it wasn't. He took the summer off, and that's when John Oliver started his rise to prominence. And
who's in it? The guy from the Motorcycle Diary.
That's the problem, is that it's very forgettable. It wasn't bad, but it's like you would think that. If Jon Stewart were to leave The Daily Show to go do a movie, that's going to be the go-to movie of the year. But kind of a letdown. It doesn't surprise me that this isn't, that it's not that great. How's it being?
But it's especially bad. It's just,
is this going to be like the first theatrical release now that theaters?
So it's both. It's being released on Friday in limited theaters. Mm-hmm. Which is probably going to be a limited release anyway. And
I imagine so. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm so excited. Seriously, I am ready to go to a movie theater. I'm ready for that experience again. I don't care if I have to wear a mask.
Yeah.
For a movie, and you know, if you didn't wear the mask, no one's going to find out anyway. But I'm now in the position. Number one, I'm so incredibly surprised I have not caught COVID. I feel like I get sick on a dime, and I've not gotten it.
I am surrounded by hundreds of people every day. Like, there's the pretend social distancing rules that are supposed to be in place, but nobody's following them. Like, they're supposed to be one way aisle.
Doesn't it make you to question the underlying facts that we know about coronavirus? It is very weird. And I don't question the facts. But I do, like, logically, I start to question it a little bit of like, man, this is uber contagious. It's the most contagious virus that we've known. I go on the bus. I've been in cars with people.
But you're sharing
earpieces with people, and I'm not getting sick.
But you wear masks.
I don't wear I wear a mask.
I think that's the one thing that's really altered is that masks are proving to be actually pretty good at preventing you from getting coronavirus.
Fauci for me, last week finally acknowledged, not that anyone like the smart people of us we knew. The reason why they were saying no to the masks, don't wear the masks, don't buy the masks, is because at that point they wanted to make sure that hospital workers got it. And if you're spending your time indoors like you're supposed to, you don't really need a mask.
Yeah.
And but it, the way I think everyone on both sides of the aisle messaged that, they set it up to make it very easy to simply dismiss masks now. And even just like 3 weeks ago, the WHO put out a study that said it could be either way, whether or not it helps or hurts. And to me, logically, it makes sense that it helps, but it's just weird messaging around the masks.
But I know we focus on the people who are like, I'm not wearing a mask because I'm the new Paul Revere or whatever. But I'm out in public and the overwhelming majority, I mean, we're talking like 3/4 of people. It's still jarring to see someone not with a mask on. So,
do you wear a mask when you're out?
Oh,
like
yeah.
Outside?
I just, it's just something I just throw on now.
Yeah. I don't do that unless I'm in a position where I literally, there's someone around me. If I'm, there's no reason to wear a mask when I'm walking home.
There's no reason. Just to make it so I don't walk out of the house with it one day. Like it's such an afterthought now. It's like putting on shoes. It's just the last thing before I leave the house, I put the mask on.
How many do you own?
5.
Right. How many times have you washed them?
Oh, I washed there. I've really only been using one, and I hand wash it like every 3 days.
You're supposed to wash it every time you leave the house with it.
Oh, well, then it would never not be wet.
I've got this device that's called phone soap, but it's basically UV light that you put your phone in. I'm the same way. I've got 5 and at this point I bought one that's the pretty one, that's the designer one that I don't want to wear because I don't want to get it dirty, but I'll take selfies in it. Then the other ones I bought locally from a company called Gray and May out of Auburn. It's like $18. It's well made. You throw it in the washing machine, but I'm not worried. And it's very clear. The numbers make it very clear that it's not only, but it most impacts people 60 plus and really 80 plus. So I'm not nearly as concerned or anxious as I once was. I'm expecting that I'm going to get it like I get the flu.
Yeah. I think it's going to be reading about the possible effects on the lungs has me a little unnerved, but I just don't want to get it. I just don't want to.
Totally. And I don't want to get it because that means you're really out of commission for 2 weeks.
Yeah.
If I was sick, I could broadcast from the house, I guess.
Yeah.
And if I was otherwise fine, other than just knowing I have it and I'm asymptomatic, which I wouldn't even know. If I'm asymptomatic, I've always got symptoms of something.
Yes.
I'm tired all the time. My throat sometimes hurts.
Is your back still always? Your back always hurts.
I have always got symptoms.
Yeah.
I have not had it yet as of a month ago or 3 weeks ago when I got the antibody test, they didn't find it. So I suppose it's possible between then and now I've gotten it. But I'm super surprised. But I'm assuming I'm going to get it like everybody else.
I'm probably going to get it at some point. But I want to prevent that point from coming as long as possible, I guess. I don't want to just like get it over with. So
you don't you kind of, I'm almost in the camp. If I'm 100% going to get it, I'd rather be able to get it now versus when finally the world is opening up and I can go on a vacation and then just get hit with it right before the vacation.
Yeah. But I'm just hoping maybe I can
you're hoping to get the vaccine.
Maybe the vaccination. Yeah. Maybe the vaccination will come.
Fauci. Yeah. What it was yesterday, 2 days ago, goes, yeah, we're likely going to see it by the end of the year, maybe early 2021.
The whole world working on it. Like they're every day. It seems like I'm reading about these different trials that are trying these different things. And it's like, this is great that there are brilliant minds in, you know, every hemisphere. So it's,
have you thought about let's just pick whatever the disease is, something simple like the cold or serious like brain cancer. Mm-hmm. If the entire world pretty much spent just 1 year tackling that one thing,
right,
and just pouring money into it, what we would do? Just everything from literally not having a cold, which economically is a good thing to get rid of because it means you get to go to work, or brain cancer, or like herpes, or baldness, whatever it is. Like,
totally.
If everyone just focused on it, it is weird. I feel like we'd be able to get eradicate some of these diseases.
On January 1st, there's just this lottery with like balls with different disease names on them. Then, all right, this year we're working on gout. And we're going to eliminate gout. That would be great. I'd love that.
Yeah, because I imagine some of them, you know, if you're talking about the scale that we're attacking the coronavirus, let's use gout. Maybe gout takes 4 months of the entire globe spending time on it rather than a year.
Yeah.
Right. And maybe something like a cancer or an AIDS or something, it takes 2 years. But just like you just jump on it. Obviously, I wouldn't put gout in there. I would go with the stuff that is the highest likelihood of someone getting and the highest rate of death or mortality, whatever it is. It is just weird that we can't kind of do that. Because it's not like right now no one else is studying anything else. There is just this, it's the equivalent of the Black Lives Matter movement of, well, yeah, all lives matter, but right now Black Lives Matter. And it's the same thing of like, yes, it's also important to go after skin cancer, but right now we're focusing on HIV.
Yeah. I don't know, write up a proposal.
What? That's my monologue tomorrow.
Bring it up with Tucker.
I will throw it in at the end.
So you're saying, Jason, it's his face.
I love Tucker.
Have you heard the insults that John Oliver uses for Tucker?
I don't want to know. I don't want to know that. I have a good relationship with them, I don't care.
Tucker,
John Oliver, I think, is so unfunny. I understood Stephen Colbert. I understood Jon Stewart. I kind of understand Trevor Noah, even though I don't find him to be particularly funny. I don't get John Oliver.
And I question what...
He's not funny.
Yes, he is funny.
No.
Jason, he makes a living being funny.
He does a once-a-week show that 12 people write for him, okay? You know what I do every day? Fresh content. Alone.
It would be lovely to have 12 writers. That does make life sound easier. But
imagine if he didn't have any writers.
No, everybody's funnier with 12 writers.
Twelve would probably double that.
I don't know what it is, but it's definitely more than 10, which is insane that you have 10 people.
You should know every single writer on that show and every single writer on all of these shows. I don't know how writers, especially comic writers, have the self-respect enough to be like, you go ahead and take credit for everything that I do.
I suppose the same as most screenwriters too.
But screenwriters, I guess you're right.
Yeah.
But there is an acknowledgement. I don't think people realize the joke writing part from a staff that goes into a Jimmy Kimmel or whatever versus you know that Leonardo DiCaprio didn't write that.
Right. Script. Right. Right.
Everyone knows that.
That's true.
And especially just for the comic stuff, because Jimmy Kimmel, while I'm sure he's a funny, like I've heard him do interviews, he can be charming and amusing. He's not a stand-up.
No.
He doesn't write his own material.
He was I don't even know what his background is. All of a sudden he was on the Mad Show.
He was a sports caster with the morning show on K-Rock, Kevin and Bean.
Okay. That's right. I forgot.
But versus Adam Carolla, who does stand up comic, whether or not you like him, he does his own material. Mm-hmm. And he's a weird stand because he doesn't do traditional stand up. He's got his own set, but a lot of it is just riffing. He just happens to be really funny in those moments. But right. David Letterman and all those, but Jon Stewart, they didn't write all their own material.
But they, you know, that there's a reason there's 12 writers, one performer. Like the performance is still
totally
the most typical part.
Yeah, but you're performing someone else's material, and in a way, you're getting all the credit for stuff you didn't write, you didn't create.
I wonder, you probably grapple with that, especially because Jon Stewart does have a stand-up background. You probably do. That is a weird transition you have to make until you realize my life is amazing. I don't have to generate 95% of my jokes or 100% of my jokes. I don't even know, you know.
Oh, his perspective. If someone wrote all my material and it killed her, fine. I'm happy with that.
Coming from a stand-up background where you know, your pride is writing your own stuff and not taking anybody else's ideas, it probably is weird. But then again, you know, the paycheck comes and you give up that.
Here's your $14 million for the quarter.
Exactly. All right. I have to start making dinner and I have to pee.
I do too. Okay. Goodbye. Say goodbye to your kitten.
All right. Goodbye.
Bye, everybody. Thank you so much for tuning in to the after show. By the way, if you are listening to this on the podcast and you want to watch the video, you can catch us every week on Wednesday. We usually do this at facebook.com/JasonRantsShow. Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.